Taylor.
I'm Kat.
And welcome to Square Mile of Murder. Now, if you're listening to this in real time as it comes out, it's almost Christmas. If you're not, it was almost Christmas. And so we decided, you know, we would like take it easy. And instead of having like this whole complex thought out plan for which case we were going to do today, we decided to pick one at random from Kat's Lady Bird book of serial killers. Which,
yes, that is a real thing.
It is. It's a real thing. And in
I mean, it's not from Lady Bird, but it's essentially the same thing.
Same idea. It's fine. So in doing so, we managed to come up with someone that we hadn't actually heard of before. So that was lucky. And it was a man whose crimes spanned 13 years across 8 countries, 2 continents, and involved everything from vehicle theft and armed robbery to identity theft, smuggling, and murder. Got the whole smorgasbord there.
There's even a Charles Manson-style family cult, jewel theft, crazy prison swap story that sounds like something out of a Hollywood film.
Yeah.
And not one, but 4. Yes, 4 prison breaks.
I feel like that's too many.
I mean, that's just greedy.
Yeah.
Most people don't even get one.
Yeah, right?
And we're quite lucky because there's actually a BBC Netflix co-production series coming out in a couple of weeks about this particular criminal.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the Lady Bird book does deliver sometimes. This week, we are talking about The Serpent, The Bikini Killer, The Hippie Trail Killer, Charles Sobrage.
Charles Sobrage was born, please forgive me, this will not be pronounced correctly, Hachand Baonani Gurumukh Charles Sobrage, something like that, on the 6th of April, 1944, in Saigon, French Indochina. He was the son of an Indian businessman and a Vietnamese shop worker. Now, if you're up on your French Empire history, which I don't know that many people are these days, but...
Well, we're not.
No.
We're just...
No, definitely not.
We just know how Google works.
Yeah. So you might know that Saigon is the old name for Ho Chi Minh City, which is the most populous city in Vietnam. The French Indochina Union, or the Indochinese Federation, was the name for a number of countries and states in Southeastern Asia, which had been colonized by the French, which included Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and parts of China. Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos became independent following the Geneva Conference in 1954, which produced the Geneva Agreements that were signed by France and North Vietnam but rejected by South Vietnam and the US.
A year later, the Vietnam War began, and we do not have time to get into that one at all.
No.
But all of this is to say that Charles Sobrage was born at a time of real upheaval
to say the
in
least.
The region.
Yeah.
Not only was he grown up at a time of war and violence, but his parents also divorced when he was young, about 2 years old, and his father abandoned the family. Sobrage's mother went on to marry a French army lieutenant who was stationed in French Indochina, and he would eventually adopt young Charles. And the family moved a lot between France in Vietnam, and Charles was actually passed back and forth a lot between his parents, so he never really had a stable childhood. And what's also quite interesting is that at one point he was technically classed as stateless, so he had no nationality. He wasn't Vietnamese, he wasn't Indian, and he wasn't French. And this was until he was adopted by his stepfather, and they all eventually gained French citizenship. We don't know a great deal about his childhood. We know that, I would say, he was passed around back and forth quite a bit. He was neglected emotionally in favour of his younger half-siblings on both sides. Both his parents remarried. And neither of his parents really wanted him. He acted out a lot, which is no surprise. That's how what happens when kids are neglected and they want attention. They act out.
Mm-hmm.
Some act out because they're little shits, but some also do act out because they want attention because they are constantly being rejected.
Yeah.
But neither of his parents really knew how to deal with him or what to do with him when he did act out. And the answer just seemed to be to send him back to the other parent.
Probably not helping matters a lot.
No.
So for most serial killers, there's usually some sort of like sexual motivation or trigger for their crimes. Sort of you see in the case of like Andre Chikatilo, he could only feel arousal while dominating someone much smaller and weaker than him. Or Dennis Nilsen, who killed people so that they could never leave him. We've covered both of those lovely chaps in prior episodes, so if you want to get more into that, you can go listen to those. But Sobraj's MO is more closely related to another serial killer case or cases that we covered, the senior citizen serial killers Ray and Faye Copeland. And their primary motivation was financial gain. And the whole murder part of it was them just sort of cleaning up the mess they made in order to make money. So this is more similar to that than your sort of, I guess, more traditional serial killers.
Yeah, like your 70s golden age serial killer.
Your sexual gratification killers.
Yeah.
And this is actually quite clear in the first crime that he was convicted of. He started off with petty crimes like burglaries in Paris when he was in his late teens. In 1963, at the age of 19, he was convicted and sentenced to 3 years in Poissy prison near Paris. Poissy near Paris.
During his sentence, Sobraj befriended a prison volunteer named Félix Desconnier, who is described on the interwebs as a wealthy young man. And, you know, like a lot of wealthy people, instead of doing something meaningful, they just kind of throw their money at something and be like, yay, I helped. although he did actually go into the prison, whereas a lot of his contemporaries would just donate money, he did actually go in to the prison and worked with the prisoners. And when he was paroled, Sobraj moved in with Félix, we believe in Paris or in the Paris area. And according to Wikipedia, because I couldn't find another source for this, once he was paroled, Sobraj split his time between the high society of Paris and the criminal underworld. One may argue that in a Venn diagram, that is a circle.
Yeah, certain instances, I could see that. Definitely being the case.
You tell I've been in a bitchy mood this week.
She's pulling punches, ladies and gentlemen.
For the next few years, Sobraj kept his head down and stayed out of trouble. Or at least he didn't get caught for whatever he was up to. Which was, you know, running in all of these organised crime upper crust circles. And he was reportedly running a series of small-time scams and burglaries. That was until he was caught in 1969, when he was arrested for evading police whilst driving a stolen car, which he was sentenced to 8 months in Poissy prison.
So he's becoming a regular at Poissy, apparently.
Yeah.
But
maybe it's like your third stay is free.
Yeah, yeah. Or like you get like the.
You get a little stamp card.
Yeah, like you get the cell with the extra window or something. You upgrade your stay.
Like, this is my third stay in 5 years. Can I get a better room?
Yeah, all right. I'm a gold member here at the prison, so I think you'll find that I've accumulated enough points that I need an upgrade.
I'd like to exchange my points for a easily bribable prison officer, please.
And a continental breakfast. Thank you and good night. But it turned out that in between all of those scams and all the running around with rich people with limited or lack of morals, Sobhraj had also been doing a fair bit of philandering, as one does, and he was a good con man, so he managed to charm all the rich eligible bachelorettes of Paris. And in that time, he had entered into a relationship with a young Parisian socialite named Chantal Compagnon. And just hours before he was arrested, he proposed to her. Very romantic.
Yeah.
Now, Chantal stood by him while he was inside. And when he was released on parole a few months later, the couple got married. And in 1970, Sobhraj and the now pregnant Chantal fled France. Reports say that it was to avoid arrest because he had committed a number of robberies and run several scams, including check fraud. So they fled France in a, quote, borrowed car from Felix Desconnier. So they stole his car and left the country. The couple traveled overland to India through Eastern Europe and the Middle East. They traveled on fake passports and befriended travelers along the way before robbing them and moving along. So they're just making friends everywhere they go.
Yeah.
Their aim had been to reach Vietnam, where Sobhraj's father still lived, and he was hoping that a new baby would endear him to his estranged family. But heavily pregnant Chantal struggled with the journey, and the couple only got as far as India.
The couple eventually reached Mumbai quite late in the year, which I believe was still called Bombay at the time.
I looked it up. 1995 was the name change, so
yeah,
definitely.
I had a feeling it was in our lifetime, because I remember hearing it referred to as Bombay when I was young. So, they reached Bombay, or Mumbai. Chantal gave birth to a daughter who they named Usha. I want to make a joke about the singer, Usher. It's just not coming to me.
Make your own joke, listeners.
Insert joke here. The couple settled into the expat community in Mumbai, presenting themselves as respectable upper-class people, providing a stable environment for their baby daughter. But Sobhraj soon went back to his life of crime because, one needs money to appear rich.
I mean, yeah.
And his choice of crime this time was thieving cars and running smuggling operations. His specialty was acquiring luxury European cars for Mumbai's upper classes, who didn't want to deal with all the bureaucracy and red tape and taxes that importing expensive European cars generated.
Yeah.
It wasn't cheap. So Sobhraj would buy European cars on the black markets in the Middle East and have them smuggled into India. You'd have them stripped down, so they're pretty much just a shell, and that would leave them worthless. He would report them as stolen to police in Mumbai, so he could then claim on the insurance, so he'd have them insured as soon as he bought them. So he claimed on the insurance. Then when they were found, because they were worthless, he didn't want them back, so they went straight to the police auction. Stripped down, like I say, absolutely worthless, so... yeah, they sold at auction, but for very little.
Mm-hmm.
So Braj went along, bid in the client's name. Then, bidding in the client's name meant that they were legally the owners as far as the police were concerned. He then took the car back to the mechanic who stripped them down. He would then put the cars back together. So now you had the original luxury car, you know, reassembled, some assembly required.
Yeah, the IKEA version of the car.
And the client would be the legal owner without having to go and deal with customs and all of that.
I mean, it's complex. It's brilliant.
It is. And that really does speak to his intelligence as well, that he could mastermind that.
And do, like, pull it off, not just once, but, like, multiple times.
Yeah.
Like, that's very impressive.
Yeah.
So he came up with this whole scam. He was pretty damn good at it. He would charge his clients about £20,000 per car, plus the money claimed from the insurance companies, which meant that Sobhraj was earning a pretty great living from his criminal activities. But instead of using the proceeds of his crimes to provide for his family, Sobhraj instead just chucked all that money into a newly discovered hobby. He had a great fondness for gambling, which isn't great.
No.
But does sound like in keeping with his personality.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So this sort of happy, settled life and crime life in Mumbai?
I know in some Indian religions the cow is sacred, but they don't name the cities after it.
Not quite like that. In Mumbai, didn't last long, and less than a year later in 1971, the couple fled India, settling in Kabul, Afghanistan. But rather than settle down and get jobs, you know, that old boring thing, the two of them decided that they would just live it up, live their best lives with an extended stay at the Intercontinental Hotel. And they racked up quite a bill there, which they would never actually pay. So, you know, it's one way to live in the lap of luxury.
Yeah.
During this time, Sobhraj made plenty of contacts for his latest smuggling venture, which was moving weapons over land from Afghanistan to be sold on the black market in India.
Because I think in the 70s there was war going on in parts of India and Bangladesh.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's be real. There's always a black market for weapons, no matter if it's war or peace.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he was working that angle, but he supplemented the family's income by once again befriending travelers, mostly Western hippie types, before robbing them of money and valuables.
So we have to remember that Afghanistan was a very different place in the early 1970s to how it is now.
Yeah.
For our generation, we've mostly grown up with the images of the so-called War on Terror. And before that, it was the Gulf War in the sort of late 80s, early 90s. And before that, in the late 70s, was the Soviet War, or Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. But back in the sort of early 70s, it was an integral part of the hippie trail. And it was as much a destination for backpackers as India, Nepal, and Thailand, Syria, Pakistan, Jordan, even Iran and Iraq were also big stops on the hippie trail. The Middle East was a much different place back then to how we think of it now. And there was a constant stream of idealistic young people coming through who, sadly, were the perfect targets for Sobhraj.
Yeah. The couple fled Kabul in December 1971 and headed for Rawalpindi in Pakistan. And it was here that Sobhraj committed his first murder, according to Crime and Investigation. Sobhraj drugged a taxi driver in order to steal their car, but the driver ended up dying from an overdose of whatever substance it was that Sobhraj had drugged them with. Sadly, we don't know the name of the driver or anything about them, just that they died during the time that Subraj lived in Rawalpindi. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it happened in Rawalpindi, because he was always moving around and smuggling arms across national borders, so it technically could have happened anywhere. And this person isn't listed on any of list of Subraj's victims. The only source that we could find mentioning them was Crime and Investigation, but they didn't list the driver on the victim list, just sort of in the text and the narrative about Subraj's life and crimes.
Yeah, and that's the only source that I could find reference to this man's death. And also the only source I could find that said they even lived in Rawalpindi. So according to Crime and Investigation, who we did use to try and build a timeline of his story, but you'll see why that gets a bit difficult in a bit.
Yeah.
There were also rumours of Subraj living in Bangkok at some point in 1972 or 1973, after the family fled Kabul, and that he was running like a touristy souvenir type of shop. The article even alleges that Subraj would prey on the visitors to his shop, drugging them, robbing them, and sometimes even killing them, usually by them overdosing on whatever he used to drug them. Much the same as he did with the taxi driver when he lived in Rawalpindi. But again, none of these victims are named or listed anywhere that we can find. It's almost just like a passing comment in this article that we found. So, again, we're not entirely sure if this is fact or the rumour mill going into overdrive. Because we've talked about it a lot before, that when a serial killer is found, if they were in an area when other murders were committed, people will try and tack them on to the serial killer who's been identified, because we don't like the idea of a killer not being found.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So it might be, oh, well, he was, you know, in Southeast Asia at this time, so he must have committed every murder on the hippie trail.
Yeah, no,
exactly. No, he didn't.
No, probably not.
Chantal got sick of this life of crime, constantly moving around, having to look over their shoulders. So in the early 70s, she left Subraj and returned to her native France with their daughter and filed for divorce.
So that's one version of what Charles Subraj was doing in the early 70s. There's another version. So this is where the stuff kind of gets complicated in terms of timelines and everything, but bear with us.
Yeah.
According to the podcast Serial Killers, in 1971, the couple sent their daughter back to France to live with Chantal's family, and they then fled to Hong Kong on an extended vacation because Subraj now had a reputation for skipping out on his tab at the casinos around Mumbai. Conning and scheming their way into Hong Kong's upper classes, they managed to enjoy the high life. Now, Hong Kong is a very short ferry ride from Macau, which was once a Portuguese colony and is well known for its casinos. And wouldn't you know it, gambling addict Subraj just couldn't resist that siren call across the water, across the bay. And he quickly racked up debts of more than £50,000, which he couldn't pay because he didn't have a job. He tried selling off his wife's expensive jewelry, but that didn't make much of a dent in the bill. So, in late 1971, Subraj got involved with another criminal who was planning a jewel heist at a hotel in Delhi, India.
So, as we said, we don't really know which version is true about where the couple went after they fled Mumbai. We know that they spent time in Hong Kong, Macau, Pakistan, Afghanistan, but we're just not entirely sure of what order or how many times they were in each country. But what we do know was that they were back in India in 1971 for the jewel heist at the Ashoka Hotel with a group of other criminals. So this running around to Kabul and then Thailand and Hong Kong supposedly only happened in the space of a few months.
I mean, they're efficient.
Yeah. The hotel, Ashoka Hotel in Delhi, had a jewel store on the first floor, so the group would rent rooms directly above it. And when the store closed, they tried to drill through the floors and steal the gems. It's very simple when you think about it. And so Braj, with all of his smuggling expertise, was in charge of moving the stolen jewels out of Delhi. But of course, something went wrong.
Obviously.
The floors were made of marble, and the drills they brought were no match for such a stone. So after 3 days and many broken drill bits, Sobhraj changed tack. He called the store, under the guise of being a potential customer, asking them to bring a selection of jewels to the hotel room. So when the shop clerk brought the jewels to the room, Sobhraj and the others held him at gunpoint, forced him to take them back to the store, where they stole a case of jewels and $10,000 in cash.
Not exactly as seamless an operation as their original plan.
Yeah. Like, it's a very different skill set.
Yes. Yes. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
So when Sobhraj got to the airport, he ran into more trouble. The jewel shop had obviously reported the robbery, and now they were searching the airport for the culprits. While he was in line waiting to board a plane, the police walked past Sobhraj, led by the shop clerk whom they had held at gunpoint. So he just walked out of the airport and left the bag of jewels in the line where he had been standing, and he returned to Mumbai. Back in Mumbai, he quickly went back to a life of crime, and just 2 weeks later, he was arrested for car theft. And while in custody, he was linked to the armed jewel robbery at the Ashoka Hotel. But Sobhraj wasn't interested in just sort of giving in and going to trial, so he hatched a plan to escape. After a few weeks in custody, he faked severe stomach pain and was rushed to the hospital with what doctors believed to be appendicitis. So they operated on him, and then they kept him cuffed to a hospital bed while he recuperated. But because it was a hospital, not a prison or jail, whatever, his wife was allowed to visit him, and so she did. And she drugged the guard by slipping chloroform into his drink, and then stole the keys to the handcuffs while he was passed out. And then Chantal took Sobhraj's place in the hospital bed while he fled. That part, I don't get.
So I think it was, you know, if you were covered up by all the, you know, bedding and everything, you could kind of make it look like...
It's like until someone checks to... Yeah.
Yeah, and so, until someone comes and checks closely, it would appear that there was someone in the bed, the guard was in there somewhere. Uh-huh. Nobody passing by really had any worry.
Yeah.
You know, any reason to worry.
See, that makes more sense than what I was picturing, which was like her just sitting up in bed being like, well, there's someone chained to the bed. Aren't you happy with that?
No, it's not quite like an Al Capone situation where it's like, okay, you can have my wife instead of me.
Take my brother, please. Yeah, so she took his place. Now, fittingly and appropriately, Chantal was arrested for aiding this escape stunt, but she managed to persuade a friend to pay her bail. And once she was released, the couple reunited and then went on the run again. They briefly returned to Europe, where they pulled a number of small-time scams in early 1972, but eventually they headed for Kabul.
This version of events seems to kind of link up with the other version that we have, only a few years later. So The couple stayed in a hotel in Kabul running scams and robbing tourists until Sobhraj was arrested in 1973. Although the exact reasons aren't clear. Some say it was for an unpaid hotel bill because they were just living their best lives. Others say it was for some of the scams and robberies that he was running in Kabul. Either way, he was thrown into prison, and there is nothing cushy about Afghani prisons. There is a certain resilience that's associated with Afghanistan and its people. Throughout all of history, so many nations have tried to invade and conquer Afghanistan, but none have succeeded in the long run. And in lots of very patronising Western documentaries about it, it's kind of chalked up to being this sense of collective resilience and a very unique mindset of Afghani people. What this then meant for Sobhraj was that it wasn't quite as easy for him to bribe his way into a comfortable life as he'd been able to do in the Indian and French prisons. And the guards weren't vulnerable to his charms and cons, as others had been. And conditions weren't great either.
Yeah. So he realized that to escape from this prison, he was going to have to up the ante. So Sobhraj once again faked an illness in prison, but this time, instead of just saying, "Hey guys, my stomach hurts, help me," he drew his own blood and then drank it, so it appeared that he was vomiting blood. Prison guards were worried that he was suffering from a perforated ulcer, so they rushed him to the hospital. Once there, he drugged a guard, then broke out of his chains and walked out the front door, where he reunited with Chantal. And the couple once again went on the run, fleeing Afghanistan and eventually traveling west. In late 1973, they returned to France and reunited with their daughter, who would have been about 3 years old at this point.
We should point out that at this point, Sobhraj is still only 29. He's literally the same age that we are.
I mean, he's a lot more productive than I am, I'll tell you that much.
I know. I haven't even had one prison break, let alone two at this point.
I haven't smuggled any cars or arms in or out of countries recently.
I've never drugged somebody.
No. But like, yeah, no, he's an industrious young criminal, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Very efficient. But like, Chantal started to realize this is maybe not for her. So when she was reunited with Usha, Chantal decided that she wanted a more settled life in France as a mother, instead of being, you know, a constant outlaw living a life of crime with Sobhraj. So she filed for divorce and vowed to never see him again. But he didn't really seem to care so much, because he was already thinking about who could be his next accomplice. And although his parents, step-parents, siblings, and now his wife had all vowed to never see him again, there was one family member who he still had a relationship with. That was his younger half-brother, Andre. Andre was 8 years younger than Sobhraj, and he had always looked up to his older brother. And the two had maintained a correspondence while Sobhraj was gallivanting about India and Afghanistan, running his various schemes. So, with no other accomplices, or more accurately, no other easy victims for him to use, Sobhraj convinced his younger brother, who was about 21, to join him in his latest scam, and the two headed to southeastern Europe.
It's pretty clear that Sobhraj is a stone-cold psychopath who used and abused whoever he needed to get whatever he wanted, showing no empathy or remorse for who he hurt along the way. But throughout his life, he had also been displaying signs of Machiavellianism. Machiavellianism is the political philosophical belief that the ends justify the means, named for the 15th century Italian diplomat Niccolò Machiavelli, who espoused these ideas. In psychology, Machiavellianism is part of the dark triad, the other two sides being psychopathy and narcissism. And the main traits of someone with Machiavellianism are manipulativeness, callousness, along with an inability to recognise emotions in others, and a complete lack of empathy. So there is a lot of overlap between these three elements of the triad. It's more of a Venn diagram than a triangle. Yeah. Those who display Machiavellian traits are selfish, they have a complete disregard for others, and seek to dominate other people to carry out their will for them. So Braj had always manipulated his younger brother to carry out whatever he wanted for him. At the age of 10, he had convinced then 2-year-old Andre to steal from a local shop, and when he was caught, Andre, being 2 years old, dobbed his brother in it. But Sobraj simply shrugged and said at least he knew there was always one person he could control.
Yikes.
Yeah.
So after the brothers reunited, following Sobraj and Chantal's divorce, they headed to Istanbul in Turkey. Sobraj was half Vietnamese, half Indian, and Andre was half Vietnamese and half French. And this gave both of the brothers a sort of ambiguous ethnicity, for lack of a better term, to call it. But basically, people couldn't really place where they were from, especially since Sobraj was fluent in multiple languages. So they, you know, couldn't even place their accents when they were talking to them. And this ambiguity made it easy for them to appear to be locals pretty much everywhere throughout Southeastern Europe, the Middle East, India, and Southeast Asia. So to travelers who were just, you know, passing through traveling through Turkey, it was easy for the brothers to appear to be tour guides or just friendly locals willing to help out someone who was lost, which in turn made it a lot easier for the brothers to rob the unsuspecting travelers.
So we've mentioned it a couple of times already, but we should probably explain exactly what the hippie trail actually is.
Yeah.
These days, it tends to refer to parts of Southeast Asia, sort of India, Thailand, Cambodia, Myanmar, Laos, Vietnam, Nepal, sometimes even Bhutan. It is basically a group of countries where white Westerners go on their gap year to find themselves whilst traipsing around temples for religions they don't belong to and building orphanages despite having zero labouring skills. From the late 1940s to the late 1970s, the hippie trail was a bit different, and it was an actual route from Southeastern Europe to Southeastern Asia, and technically it did start in Technically, it started in Istanbul.
Not Constantinople. So. Istanbul, not Constantinople. Not Istanbul.
Travelers would come from all over the US and Western Europe, and they would all head to Turkey, where the trail started. From there, they would travel by road. So this is usually hitchhiking or in VW campers. So they mostly would go south to Syria and Jordan and Iraq and then on to Iran. Or they would go east through Turkey and straight into Iran, where the routes joined up. Iran led to Afghanistan, then Pakistan, and through the famous Khyber Pass, which is a very steep mountain pass. And eventually it would go south to Lahore and then into northern India. The trail then splits again in Delhi. Some continued south through India, splitting again for either Goa or Sri Lanka. Some went northeast to Nepal and the temples and stupas of Kathmandu. The final route went east into Bangladesh, and then they would travel by boat to Bangkok, because they'd have to miss out Myanmar, which was still a very closed off country at that time. The hippie trail came to a bit of an abrupt end in the late 1970s when war in the Middle East started up again. Revolution in Iran led to it becoming a closed off country, and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan meant that that too was a no-go for most Western travellers.
The brothers conned travellers in Istanbul, robbing them not just of their money but also of their passports, which allowed Sarraj to pass easily between countries in the region without being detected, and then returned to prison in either India or Afghanistan. Some reports say that they had as many as 10 false identities each.
That's just greedy.
It's a lot. So the police agree. And that they would replace the photos in the stolen passports with their own.
Which was much easier to do back then.
Yes, definitely.
Didn't have biometric passports back then.
No RFID chips to copy and splice and all kinds of shit. So when things got a little bit sticky for them in Turkey, they traveled to neighboring Greece and continued preying on vulnerable tourists, still able to blend in and appear to be locals. But after 2 years of conning their way around Turkey and Greece, authorities caught up with the pair, and they were arrested in Athens in Greece in 1975 after trying to con an Egyptian businessman. The businessman went to the police and was able to identify the brothers when he saw them again on the streets of Athens. But of course, Sarraj wasn't about to give up his life of crime and, you know, serve the time that he should have for his ill deeds. No. He knew that there would be international warrants out for his recapture and return to prison in India and Afghanistan. But his brother Andre had no rap sheet, no such warrants. Sarraj had also studied the legal systems and the reported prison conditions in the various countries he'd committed crimes in. He knew it was only a matter of time before the authorities connected him with a string of robberies and scams in Turkey, and he also knew that Greek prisons were far more comfortable than Turkish prisons. So he devised a scheme to get both him and Andre out of prison and back onto the hippie trail.
Because Andre had no previous convictions, Sarraj knew that he wouldn't get much more than a slap on the wrists, maybe a fine. Either way, he would be released pretty much immediately. Whereas with his rap sheet, he was looking at least 20 years in Greece and Turkey before being extradited back to India and Afghanistan. So he convinced his younger brother to trade identities with him. So Sarraj claimed he would get released as Andre, then Andre would go to the prison warden and tell them that they had released the wrong brother. And then they would have to release Andre, and Sarraj would already be on the run. The brothers would reunite at a prearranged time and place. But of course, this didn't go quite as planned.
Shocking.
Shockingly indeed, the Greek prison service weren't particularly happy with the brothers trying to play them for fools. So instead of releasing the real Andre, as the brothers had planned, they extradited him straight to Turkey, where he was sentenced to 18 years hard labour.
Oops.
I think Sarraj knew exactly what would happen, and he just tricked his younger brother. He knew that Andre idolised him and that he could manipulate him into doing whatever he said, and he just saw him as just another mark to con.
It's not good either way.
No.
So once he was free from the Athenian prison, Sarraj just never looked back. This was his third prison escape. And because of this, Sarraj earned himself the nickname the Serpent for his ability to slither out of prison and slither out of pretty much any situation that involved him having to take responsibility or face any consequences for his actions or crimes. He never made any attempt to contact Andre in prison or ever apologize for leaving him to serve 18 years hard labor in Turkey.
So I don't know exactly how accurate this is or how well known it is outside of Europe, but Turkey has always had a reputation in Western Europe for its pretty horrendous human rights breaches. Yeah. So they've been trying to join the EU for more than 30 years, but there's still more than 20 criteria that they don't meet, and a lot of that is to do with human rights. So, in my opinion, you have to be a pretty stone-cold psychopath to leave your little brother to face that. Especially when you think that places like Turkey or pretty much anywhere that has like hard labour sentences, especially long ones like 18 years, you weren't expected to walk out at the end of your sentence. You either died or you were broken by the system.
Yeah. It's just...
it wasn't something that you came out and just put behind you and went on and made something of your life. Yeah.
So, without a thought for his poor brother, Subraj once again headed for the hippie trail, making his way to Thailand. And he was pulling small-time cons to pay his way along the trail. As well as impersonating tour guides and robbing tourists, Subraj also posed as a gem trader and drug dealer to raise money. It was when he got to Thailand that he realized that with his brother languishing in a Turkish prison, he needed a new accomplice. Someone who would be his loyal doormat, whom he could manipulate into doing whatever he wanted. And that was when he came up with another idea. He didn't need just one accomplice. He wanted a whole group of underlings that he could boss around, who could go out and run his scams for him and allow him to keep his hands completely clean. So he decided that he would create his own family. And that's where we're going to stop for today. and we'll pick it up again next week for our final episode of 2020. That's what we're getting to so far with this guy.
Yeah, it's really a crime of two halves. So this is a good breaking point.
Good stopping point. With that said, if you enjoy this, please give us a rating and a review and subscribe to us wherever you listen. If you want, don't forget that you can still get 20% off of our merch, which is on Teespring, and the link will be in the show notes and on social media and on our website. So you can use the code LAUNCH, LAUNCH, to get 20% off up to Christmas Day 2020. So thanks for listening, everyone, and we will see you next time.
Yeah, we'll see you next week. Yeah. Bye-bye. Bye.